Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The U.S. economic embargo against Cuba has now officially outlasted Fidel Castro. He announced this morning he'll be stepping down as president. But 49 years later, what's next? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, dedicated to serving their clients worldwide with a passion for the business of accounting. On the web at grantthornton.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Tuesday. It is the 19th of February today. And it's not like we didn't know it was coming. Castro's brother Raul has been in charge for most of the past 18 months. He's expected to get the top job officially sometime after Cuba's National Assembly meets this weekend to nominate a successor. Ever since he stepped into the spotlight, there have been rumors Raul would be more agreeable to economic reform. Still, there was no dancing in the streets of Miami today. The powerful Cuban-American community there may be relieved to see Fidel on his way out, but they can't quite decide what to do now. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports from the America's Desk at WLRN in Miami.
The first big wave of Cuban exiles came shortly after Fidel Castro took power in 1959. The second big wave started in 1980 with the Mariel boat lift, and tens of thousands of new Cubans arrive in the U.S. every year. This second wave of Cuban Americans now outnumbers the first. Joe Garcia is with the Cuban American National Foundation. He says this new generation is starting to have more influence on U.S.-Cuba policy.
The same way that the Cuban Revolution is coming to its biological end, the Cuban-American community is coming to a generational shift.
Garcia says older Cubans have gotten their family off the island, and they often take a harder line on Fidel Castro. Younger Cubans still have family on the island, and their main focus is helping them.
Their relationship to events in Cuba is much less rhetorical, much more pragmatic.
Newly arrived Cubans are at odds with the Bush administration's hard line on Cuba, which limits family travel to the island and restricts the money immigrants can send back home. Dario Moreno is with Florida International University. He says neither generation of Cuban Americans is expecting much to change with Castro's retirement.
Right now, everybody in Miami is kind of in a wait-and-see attitude. There have been many times in the past where people have expected significant change in Cuba, and it hasn't happened. So the expectations are quite low.
Cuba's National Assembly will nominate its new leader on Sunday. In Miami, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
The credit crisis bounced its way overseas today for its latest appearance in the headlines. Credit Suisse announced almost $3 billion in subprime-related write-downs. So I guess you ought to just disregard the announcement the bank made last week when it said it didn't have much exposure to U.S. banking problems. Nonprofit groups here in the States are also being affected more than they'd thought they'd be. Cities, hospitals, and schools are some of the big participants in an obscure corner of the bond market that's collapsed in the past week or so. They're called auction rate bonds, and now financial costs are skyrocketing for the people involved. Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay explains.
Local governments and nonprofits have borrowed $300 billion on the auction bond market. New York's got $4 billion of it for financing everything from hospitals to highways. Matt Anderson is spokesperson for the state's budget department. He says the collapse of this arcane market is bad news for New Yorkers.
It means higher borrowing costs for the state and ultimately for the taxpayers. In some cases, we've seen our auction rate bonds reset to nearly double the previous interest rates. And the more you spend on repaying your borrowing obligations, the less you'll have available to pay for other functions of government.
Anderson says those high interest rates are making borrowers like New York think about refinancing into more old-fashioned municipal bonds. The University of Pittsburgh Medical Center has already made that decision. The alternative is paying 17%, or $605,000 more a week. Joseph Ficera of Sabre Partners advises local governments. He says Wall Street lured cities, schools, and museums into the market by promising cheap rates on their long-term debts.
This is a very opaque market, and that's one of the biggest problems. The lesson is buyer beware. You must take into account risks.
Ficera says the auction bond market needs to be fixed. Until then, local governments can stay in the market and risk getting stuck with crazy interest payments, or get out and pay fat termination fees and higher long-term rates. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
You can think back to today when your kids ask you where you were when oil closed above $100 for the first time. Crude spiked 4.7% today, about $4.50, to close at $100.01 a barrel. A refinery fire in Texas and worries about OPEC production got the speculators going. Maybe it's enough to make you think about driving less and taking the train more. If so, be prepared for a distinctly airport-like experience. No metal detectors or anything, but plenty of other things. From Washington, John Dimsdale reports.
Starting this week, Amtrak will send out roving security teams to randomly screen carry-on luggage by swabbing bags for explosives before people board. On the trains, passengers might see bomb-sniffing dogs with armed guards. Amtrak spokesman Cliff Black says the process is designed to be as smooth as possible for passengers.
You don't have to get to the station earlier. You don't have to worry about having a nail file on you or anything like that, or liquids. You know, nothing has changed as to what's permitted and what's not for riding our trains.
Black says Amtrak's security plan is designed to keep its hassle-free advantage over air travel. That's one reason Amtrak's share of passenger traffic in the busy Northeast Corridor has grown since 2001.
In fact, we are so sensitive about the need to keep the system fluid and flowing that if it appears as if the process is going to cause the train to be delayed, we'll simply stop the process and let the train load without screening any further passengers, sending the train on its way.
Black says random baggage screening will be a deterrent for would-be bombers. And passengers like Jerry Morris at Washington's Union Station today seem to like the new security.
I have become accustomed, like most Europeans, to the new approach to traveling, and this is part of it on the airplane, and now it's going to be part of it on the train, and I welcome it and I encourage it.
Amtrak's baggage screening begins this week in the Northeast Corridor and eventually will spread to the entire system. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Traders started out strong today, but the gains on Wall Street slipped away as those oil prices rose. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Think Ben Bernanke has trouble with inflation? He's got nothing on Beijing. The Chinese government reported today its inflation rate is up 7.1% from a year ago, the biggest increase in more than a decade. Chinese manufacturers had been absorbing much of that inflation, which put the brakes on rising prices elsewhere in the world. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports the question now is whether China is going to start exporting inflation along with everything else.
Chinese poultry prices jumped 41% in January. Pork, 59%. Ouch. But economist Glenn McGuire of Societe Generale sees just a short-term food shortage. He says the coming months will bring signs China's old McDonald is picking up the slack. Egg production is up, and more meat is on the way.
It's much quicker to breed chickens and raise eggs than it is to breed cows and pigs. There's a longer supply period which is needed for that.
But Chinese shoppers worry about what's happening now, and the fear is they'll panic buy, which could lead to actual inflation. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy that can spiral, says Deutsche Bank's Jing Ma.
For example, in 1988, when inflation was hitting over 10%, people began to stockpiling things like sugar and salt and even toilet paper.
To cool inflation, Beijing is hiking interest rates and the value of its currency. The trick is not to slow down too much, just as China's export clients in North America weaken too. Jing Ma says those American buyers have another China issue, rising prices at the Chinese factory gate, especially shoes, textiles, and toys.
The low-end sectors are experiencing more pressure because their margins are being squeezed and they cannot sustain production without raising prices.
That squeezing comes from soaring wages and energy and raw material costs. Chinese producer prices are now growing at their fastest rate in 3 years. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Wisconsin and Hawaii are getting their 15 minutes of political fame today. Weather conditions couldn't be more different for primary voters. 77 degrees and sunny in Honolulu. Way, way colder than that in Milwaukee. Candidates have spent the past week or so trying to appeal to residents of both states. That's a task that management guru Charles Handy says fits the different requirements of the office they seek.
This is a wonderful month for a visitor like myself to be in America. I have the opportunity to observe your democracy at its brilliant best. Yes, we on the outside have always thought that your presidential election dramas were far too drawn out and excessively expensive. But this time round, it all seems justified. The characters in the unfolding drama could have been any casting director's dream. Between them, the candidates represent almost every aspect of American life. We watch with fascination, envy, and admiration. But, dare I say it, you have a small problem. The Founding Fathers have required you to elect a president who has to be both head of state and prime minister, the chairman and the chief executive. They are very different roles. The chairman, be it of a country or a company, has to create the narrative and tell the story. He must represent the people in the country to the world outside. He must also embody the administration to the people. The chief executive has to deliver an efficient administration. It's the old leader-manager dilemma. Few people can do both well. In fact, the British Code of Corporate Governance frowns sternly on any attempt to combine the two roles in one person. It does this not only because it is difficult, but because to give so much power to one individual is risky. Your long list of presidents conveys quite clearly which executive was best at which part of the job. I can't help but wonder whether those voting in these primaries look for an articulate and visionary chairman or a capable chief executive. To expect two for the price of one is perhaps too much to hope for, whether for an organization or a sovereign nation.
Charles Handy is a visiting scholar at the Drucker School of Management and the Drucker Institute at Claremont Graduate University. His latest book is called Myself and Other More Important Matters. Send us your thoughts. We're online at marketplace.org. Today, the ice cream maker Häagen-Dazs announced it's giving $150,000 to Penn State and $100,000 to the University of California, Davis for bee research is what that money's for. It's because the company counts on honey for 40% of its ice cream flavors, and the recent phenomenon of colony collapse disorder has jeopardized those sweet treats. Ice cream is not the only industry affected by bees. Honey's making the news in hospitals, too. Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll tells us what the buzz is all about.
The ancient Greeks and Egyptians waxed lyrical about the healing properties of honey. Religious scriptures touted as a product of the gods. Doctors used honey during World War II to treat soldiers' wounds. Antibiotics eventually displaced honey as a remedy. But now the sticky stuff's making a comeback.
A lot of people go, oh my God, do you use honey to cure your foot? I hear that all the time.
Ursula Jenkins shattered a bone in her foot in late 2006. Her doctor removed the bone fragments, but the wound would not heal. It stayed open for months. Jenkins and her doctor, Randy Nordyke, even discussed amputation.
It was white, non-healing, draining, looked like a dry lake bed.
Nordyke decided to try out a type of honey made in New Zealand. Bees make it with the nectar from the flowers of the manuka, or tea tree plant. The honey worked wonders on Jenkins.
Within 3 days, she was better than she had been in 4 months. And from there, she had significant reduction in swelling. The wound finally pinked up. And more importantly, we were able to save her from what was certainly looking like it was going to be an amputation.
Nordic's not the only one working with Manuka honey. Researchers found that Manuka possesses an enzyme similar to hydrogen peroxide that helps to keep wounds healthy. Barry Wolfenson works for Dermasciences Incorporated. His company's developed the first and only FDA-approved Manuka honey dressing. It's called MetaHoney. He hopes to also get the FDA's seal of approval to market MetaHoney as a way to fight superbugs.
The business of topical antimicrobial dressings has really boomed in this field of advanced wound care. With the advent of MRSA, VRE, other of these what are called superbugs,
Wolfenson says MetaHoney is selling well. Dermasciences has made $200,000 on the product in the 12 weeks since it came to market. The idea of using honey as a remedy makes Linda Nipschild a little nervous. She runs the busy Glendale Memorial Wound Care Center in Southern California. Nipschild's worried people will just go to the store and pour honey directly into their wounds.
We had somebody the other day that actually said they did that because they heard quotes that honey was a great thing to use on their wounds, and of course that didn't work.
Nipschild says the MetaHoney dressings have worked on a few of her patients, but she warns Manuka honey's not a cure-all. Dr. Nordyke sees things differently. After treating Ursula Jenkins' foot, he started his own Manuka honey business. He raised about $120,000 in seed money, and he came up with a catchy name.
Wound honey, wound honey, wound honey, wound honey, wound honey. Just think about Dr. Nordyke's wound honey.
Dr. Nordyke doesn't seem to be thinking of much else. He's convinced that Manuka honey is a kind of cure-all. He recommends it for everything from chronic wounds to heartburn. In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
Coming up, marketing Merlot in Morocco.
There are some people who drink wine, and we try to be able to have this product given to them on good conditions.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell 11 points today, giving up less than a tenth of 1% to close at 12,337. The NASDAQ eased 15 points, two-thirds of 1%, 2306 at the bell. The S&P 500 slipped a point, closing basically flat at 1348. Crude at $100 sent shares of Exxon bubbling up nearly 2%. Close behind was brand new Dow component Chevron up 1.5%. The National Association of Home Builders said confidence was up this month. Pulte Homes took heart, climbing 4.25%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note ticked up to 3.9%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working to help reduce greenhouse gases with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. By Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. And by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home construction for January. What are voters thinking and feeling now? Results of the monthly Reuters-Zogby Index are released. It measures sentiment leading up to the presidential election. And in Phoenix, Shaquille O'Neal is slated to play against his former Laker teammates. He suits up with the Suns for his first home game. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
The first thing to say is that we don't get many actual letters from listeners anymore. Most of them are emails, of course, which presumes a certain amount of technological know-how among you. And it explains why our story about how America Online is shutting down its support for the web browser Netscape drew so many responses. Software developer Brian Cumby of Austin, Texas, wrote to remind us that rumors of Netscape's demise are premature.
The Netscape program lives on in the Firefox web browser. It's free and open for anyone to use, and it's getting many active users today.
We ventured into the field of nanotechnology last week. Scientists have developed new materials that could someday be made into clothing that would then generate electricity. We made it sound like the nanofiber revolution is coming soon to a closet near you. Irene Kagenman of Brooklyn, New York, writes and edits for science journals. She says a nano researcher does not a tailor make.
Your story said that a shirt, an entire shirt, was made. In reality, Dr. Wang's team assembled 6 nanowires, each of which is about 1,000 times smaller than human hair.
Last week, commentator Brian Palish lobbied for the free speech rights of Washington lobbyists. Bruce Dixon here in Los Angeles wrote with a rebuttal. Lobbyists, he says, have plenty of well-paid-for access to the protections of the First Amendment.
Yeah, free speech is lovely, but when you have more money, you have more access to free speech than people who don't.
Speaking of buying affections, last week we took a look at how advertisers push the jewelry du jour for Valentine's Day. Here's a clip from that story. Marketing expert Jan Drexler on how guys try but fail.
It's not that they're stupid or lazy. It's just that men are a little clueless when it comes to gifts.
A generalization, I know, but still, it hurt because most of us really do try. Todd Bobian of Austin, Texas, wasn't thrilled either. He points out Valentine's Day is a chance for women to spend some cash as well.
If all they're doing is sitting on the couch waiting for a present worth hundreds of dollars or more, I hope their clueless partners heard this story and wise up.
Finally, a clarification. A couple of weeks ago, we mentioned some Girl Scout troops have gone online to help sell their cookies.
And we have peanut butter patties.
Tagalongs, I said, are my favorites, which got troop leader Julia Mandeville of Londonderry, New Hampshire, excited. She set me straight about the difference between peanut butter patties and tagalongs.
They're the same thing. They're just from different bakers, so they have some of the cookies have different names because of the different bakers have named them differently.
If you think we've bitten off more than we can chew, let us know. Stop by our website. It's marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says contact. The simple pleasures of a glass of wine can be deceiving because it's not always so simple for the people making it. Never mind having to deal with things like weather and fermentation rates. Sometimes it's politics and religion. Wine is made almost everywhere today, even when it's illegal. In Morocco, where alcohol is prohibited by Islamic law, a wine festival at the end of last year brought storms of protest from politicians and the popular press. John Lawrenson reports now on the delicate business of making wine in a Muslim country.
A livestock market in the run-up to the Muslim festival of Eid, when most Moroccan fathers take a knife and sacrifice a sheep. Morocco is a deeply Muslim country, and alcohol is forbidden in Islam, so selling wine to Moroccans is illegal. Well, that's what the law says anyway. In fact, sales are booming, and Moroccan wineries are turning out 40 million bottles a year, sold in Europe, but above all, in Morocco itself. Islam or no Islam, Morocco is becoming a new wine El Dorado. A freshly uncorked rosé flows freely at the Château Roslan, just outside Meknès. This place has just been given the official status of a wine château, a first in Morocco. Around us, 2,000 acres of vineyards. The high altitude and dry, sunny climate make this a good wine-growing region. The Cellier de Meknès, the company that owns the Château Roslan, says it's reviving a tradition that goes back to the Romans. But life was easier for wine producers under the Caesars. The Cellier de Meknès is the biggest wine producer in Morocco, but there is no sign, not even a name, outside their head office in the center of Meknès that might draw attention or provoke hostility. Mehdi Bouchara, organizer of the Meknès Vine Festival, is similarly modest about his company's ambitions.
Our objective is not to say that tomorrow we want each Moroccan to drink wines. We know it's not possible, and anyhow, we don't want to. There are some people who drink wine, and we try to be able to have this product given to them on good conditions.
Why?
Friday prayers, the faithful can't all fit in the mosque and spread into the surrounding streets. In elections in September, the Islamist Justice and Development Party, the PJD, won the largest number of seats in Parliament. The leader of that parliamentary group, Mustafa Hamid, was outraged by Mr. Bouchara's wine festival. Wine, he believes, is a menace for Morocco.
Among the poor in this country, there are people who work all day and spend everything they've earned on wine at night. Our prisons are full of murderers and rapists who have acted under the influence of drink. In Islam, we say that alcohol is Om al-Khabayef, the mother of all evil.
A bar in Meknes full of Moroccans. Whatever the law says, there are a lot of drinks being poured, although curtains are drawn over the small barred windows. Mustafa Hamid says if his compatriots can't be educated out of drinking, then in 5 years or so they should start closing down places like this. Hamid is on a collision course with the alcohol industry, retailers, and some men in very high places. Those men include Morocco's king and commander of the faithful, His Majesty Mohammed VI. He owns a chain of large supermarkets like this one. They sell alcohol, albeit in a separate part of the store, with separate tills and a separate entrance. I ask the wine producer Mehdi Bouchara if Morocco isn't a bit hypocritical when it comes to wine. Hypocrisy? No, he says. This is tolerance. In Meknes, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
We're going to be in the Middle East for 2 weeks' worth of live broadcasts at the beginning of next month. We've got a sneak preview on our homepage, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, we know financial information can be confusing, but people who really ought to know better have been a little perplexed themselves lately. CEOs and other top executives have been getting punked on earnings conference calls, those quarterly rituals that companies go through with Wall Street analysts. The analysts get a code and they dial in to ask questions. The executives speak without trying to say too much about profits or losses. But lately, a prankster identifying himself only as Joe Harrick from Gutterman Research has been tossing out some doozies.
Can you provide some more color as to what you're doing for your supply chain initiatives to reduce manufacturing costs per hectoliter?
Tim, you want to pick on that?
The guy who needed a second to figure out price per hectoliter? Leo Keeley, the president and CEO of the Molson Coors Brewing Company. Gutterman Research, by the way, no such company. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 10 points, less than a tenth percent. The NASDAQ down 15.6%. The S&P 500 dropped a point, basically flat. Rising oil prices to blame there. Thanks today to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, the water we drink yields some disturbing data.
So the most common drug that we took back out of our sample was psychotherapeutic agents, which was 25%.
Dude. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.